Blog Talk Radio.
TV aristocrat, pulling rabbits from his hat. Oh, well, I didn't know it worked like that. Sounds great until you do the math. And now people waking up, poking heads out of their stuff. What an expensive turtle shell. It was probably just as well, because I don't want to be the machine.
How is everybody out there doing with their American dream tonight? How's it going? This is Robin and Harry Chauvry. You know, every Monday night we do this at 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. We're glad you're here. We're glad you're here each and every Monday evening. And we do our best just to provide a little bit of levity and, most importantly, a lot of positivity to your week. Positivity. And we like to share some information just to help make this world a better place. That's what we strive for. We'd like to thank last week's special guest, Angela Christini. Wow, what a wonderful conversation we had with her. She's a wonderful, wonderful person. I believe Harry met Angela on LinkedIn. Is that right, Harry? Nod at me.
That is correct.
Awesome. And that's a great website. I haven't worked on it as much as Harry has, but lots of good contacts there. So there's a little note of positivity. If you haven't checked out LinkedIn, you never know who you're going to find. Thanks again, Angela. We really enjoyed talking to you. And that was all the way to Canada. So you know, we're just spreading out worldwide here. Remember, you can call us if you have a question for our guest or for ourselves, 347-677-0699. That's 347-677-0699. If you're already listening to us by the telephone and you want to look at the computer screen instead, you can pull us up at www.blogtalkradio.com/The Dynamic Dojo. Each week we do provide tidbits of information. Harry spends hours researching, finding those perfect little nuggets, and he is going to provide those tidbits for you coming up shortly.
Well, thank you so much, and I do appreciate your introduction. Tonight we have some special tidbits. Tidbit number one, did you realize that more than $2,300 would be saved each year by quitting a pack-a-day cigarette smoking habit? For smokers out there, I want you to know you're 2 to 6 times more likely to suffer a heart attack more than non-smokers. And let me tell you something. For one of these people that have had a heart attack, and I've had my chest ripped open, you don't want to have bypass surgery because it ain't fun. And smokers spend $17,973 more in health care in their lifetime, more than non-smokers. Tidbit number two, it's a myth. You need to diversify your investments, you know, which means spreading your risk. The truth is, most Americans do not have the money for that kind of diversification. And even if they did, it is still not the best strategy for the majority of Americans. Diversification, think of it this way. Diversification is like buying many different cars just in case one doesn't work after a few months. Too often, people throw their money into things that do not work. Now, Wall Street loves this. I mean, they do. They love to brainwash us into believing diversification is good for us, when in fact, diversification keeps us dependent upon them. Very few people buy a car without research. So why should you invest without the same due diligence? Warren Buffett has stated in many different ways, put your money into one basket and then watch that damn basket. I mean, I believe you should invest in things you love and understand. Know your money as well as you know your favorite hobby. I mean, if people knew what their money was invested in as well as they knew what their favorite football team was doing, they'd be a lot better off. Invest in things you understand. Seriously. I mean, come on, folks. How many of us really understand hedge funds or ETFs or how an MBS is divided into IOs and POSs? I mean, come on now. Stick with what you know, and most importantly, invest in you. Tidbit number three, if you're flying out of Colorado Airport and you're carrying marijuana, get ready to dump it in the trash. One airport is providing amnesty boxes for travelers to ditch their pot before boarding flights out of state.
You know, Harry, I don't normally interrupt you when you're doing the tidbits, but I couldn't help but think. Seattle and Denver, both going to the Super Bowl, right?
Yes, ma'am.
Colorado, Washington just legalized weed, right?
Yes, ma'am.
Just saying.
For those pot smokers out there, wouldn't that be a great big old Super Bowl? Never mind. Tidbit number four. I know this will piss some of you off. Or can I say that? I guess I can. It's our show. I know this will piss some of you off, but healthcare.gov underwent end-to-end security testing. And you know what? It passed with flying colors. It couldn't go into end-to-end security testing until we had it up and going, but yes, it passed. Despite all the hoopla and all those people out there wanting to fail, it passed. Now maybe, just maybe, President Obama should share network security procedures with Target and several other retailers. Tidbit number five, in recent studies conducted by the University of Florida and the University of Southern California, people who were exposed to uncivil behavior were 33% less creative and 4 times less helpful than those who were not. And the University of Chicago researchers found that when people are monitored too closely, they tend to underperform. Now, that was tidbit number five, but I got a bonus tidbit tonight, baby. I got to tell you something. I hear all this talk, you know, because we're getting to be more and more conservative in some areas of our political spectrum. What group of people have been mostly positively affected by affirmative action? You know who that group of people is? And it started, and I believe now we're going to have a reporter on here pretty soon, but I believe it started under our first president, a guy named George Washington. Affirmative action, although I don't think it was called that, affirmative action has benefited this group more than any other group.
So go ahead, tell me, Harry, what group has it benefited the most?
Veterans. Well, those are our tidbits for the evening, and I've done my work for the week.
Well, I'm glad you've done your work for the week, Harry, and I am excited to introduce our guest for tonight. Her name is Jenny Netherton Graham. She is a fifth-generation Oklahoman who has been a reporter with the Tulsa World for 20 years. She's a friend of Harry, and he invited her to be on the show with us. She graciously accepted. She is a news columnist. She writes about and provides commentary about the local people and the events of her town in the Tulsa World. She's won several regional and state awards for her work. And all of that while being a married mother of 2 elementary-age children. That wore me out. That made me a little tired just reading all of that. Jenny, are you here with us tonight?
I am. Can you hear me okay?
We certainly can. So happy to have you. Thank you for joining us. And I am going to turn the rest of the conversation over to you and Harry and let y'all just have a good time, bring some smiles to our faces. And I know you and Harry have talked about a few things y'all are going to discuss tonight. But Jenny, just once again, before I back out, thank you for joining us. Just share with us what's on your heart. Bring a smile to our faces. Here you go, Harry.
Well, Jenny, welcome.
And for those that really don't appreciate her being here, she's a friend of mine, and she came on this show anyway knowing that I may ask her anything, because she does know me, and who knows what I may ask her. Jenny, for our listeners out there, tell us a little about you and tell us what's going on in Oklahoma today.
Well, it's a big question, but I'm Jenny Graham, and I'm a native of Oklahoma. I'm a news columnist. I have worked for the Tulsa World newspaper, as Robin said, for about 20 years. Most of my time at the Tulsa World has been spent covering, as I like to say, social issues, education, homelessness, teen pregnancy, mental health issues, incarceration, all of those things that are sometimes not very uplifting, but very much a part of our fabric, our way of life. I kind of see it as sort of a social justice type beat, and I'm interested in that. I know that you were more drawn to the politics of news when we have always spoken about news, and certainly politics plays a part in what I cover, but I've always sort of been drawn to that, kind of the putting a voice to those who don't have much of a voice. And, you know, we live in a conservative state, so sometimes that can be a little bit of a kind of people at odds, which is interesting because we are also a very poor state. So while people, it's sort of an ironic situation here sometimes where people who maybe are on social welfare programs don't theoretically believe in social welfare programs. So it makes for an interesting career here. But I'm just kind of letting the conversation go where you want it to go, Harry, so I'm going to turn it back to you then.
Well, I think you hit a very good point. Most countries and most states that have a conservative stance at times seems to have the least economically beneficial for the common citizen, and I think Oklahoma is a good state for that. I love Oklahoma. You know, I was born and raised there. You and I went to grad school there. I think it's very important that people understand that politics is tied to the social and financial welfare of the citizens. But you spoke of something that's really dear to my heart. There's a couple things I want to talk about. You wrote a piece on the you know, the teen birth explosions there in Oklahoma, that there's a lot of teenage pregnancy. And what fascinates me, for years and years, you know, Oklahoma is one of the leading states of, you know, just say no, abstinence, and that will take, you know, sex education out of the schools and put it back in the home and churches where it belongs, which I'm not opposed to, you know, sex being taught in homes and churches and let, you know, let the religious and the parental aspect take over, but it hasn't seemed to work in Oklahoma. Can you tell us more about what you have found based upon your current piece about teenage pregnancies?
Oh, it definitely has not worked. And I can't think of any school that, you know, wants to take that away from the home. Not at all. As a matter of fact, they want that in the home. And to kind of give some background for the listeners who may not know anything about Oklahoma, we are currently number 4 in the country, ranking-wise, in teenage pregnancy. And I believe, yeah, the number 1 is Arkansas, Mississippi is number 2, then New Mexico, and then Oklahoma. And that is for 15 to 19-year-olds. What's sort of boosting that for Oklahoma, we're number 1 among 18 and 19-year-olds. And while there is an argument that says, well, they're legally adults, I think what struck me the most was that we have more women who are giving birth at 18 and 19 than going to our college and universities as freshmen. And I think there's a real problem there. And, you know, and certainly you have issues that go along with that. They're more likely to be in poverty. They're more likely to have, you know, be unemployed. And so we really have to look at that. And to me, of all the social issues out there, this is one that can we can actually do something about. But for whatever reason, our state has been very slow in this. And I'm seeing some change now with that. The recently, in Tulsa County at least, where we live, which is a metropolitan county, there have been some inroads being made with schools. For so long, and when I say so long, 20, 30 years, schools have just not touched this. There has been a lot of social pressure to not have sex education in school. It's just not done in this state. There have been a lot of successful pressure to keep that out of school. The only time in that, during that time, where anything was allowed into the school was for AIDS education. But even within AIDS education, there was a stress on abstinence. It wasn't so much about prevention. It was put in the biology section. And I think we have gotten to the point where business leaders especially have led the way on this. Some very influential people within the community have said enough. This is silly. We can't do that. Anything. We should be doing more for our children. And in Tulsa County, Union Schools, which is a major, arguably wealthier suburb of Tulsa, started a program called the Carrera Program, which is a sex education program. And it's been very successful. The kids who have gone through there, it's kind of hard to prove what's not happened, but they are not getting pregnant as teenagers. And some of these kids are from at-risk families. And it's a model that was based on an after-school program in New York. Tulsa Public Schools, a couple of summers ago, piloted a program of sex education. And it proved successful, and they're starting to roll that out in a more broad way across the district. And I think what people are sort of realizing is that sex education is not just about birds and bees. It's about goal setting, how to handle peer pressure. What do you know? It's about more than just sex, and I think that's what we're sort of getting to the heart of. If you, it's not only preventing teenage pregnancy; it's getting kids on the right track to a career, be that through higher education or a career tech program or something else. And that, to me, I never thought I'd see the day that Oklahoma schools would allow in these programs. So we are seeing some inroads being made, but there's so much that goes around that because teenage pregnancy runs, I've always said it runs the spectrum, because you have girls that maybe make a bad decision, but they're in healthy families, a lot of parental support. They have a child, but the grandparents are involved. But then you have a high number of generational poverty girls that their moms were teen moms, their grandmas were teen moms, the men are not involved, and that's a whole other issue. And so when we talk about teen pregnancy, one size is not fit all, and so I think that that's where the social science is sort of leading. How do you intervene in generational poverty? And part of that is at least getting girls to see another way of life besides being a teen mom.
Well, I think, you know, when I ran for office back in Oklahoma, you know, many, many years ago, it was something that, being a liberal Democrat, I had a hard time getting conservatives to understand. I think your article points it out very, very clearly. Teen childbearing, teenage pregnancy in Tulsa County alone cost $38 million. $38 million. I think sex education could be a cost saver as opposed to what I was criticized for, as opposed to costing us money. I think it saves us money. I think you pointed out also in the state of Oklahoma it costs $190 million annually. That's a whole lot of money. And for, yeah, you know, for a conservative not to want to save that money, it just baffled me. So, you know, seeing people like you stating the facts that, you know, teenage pregnancy is something we need to be concerned with. And something else, I really like your article. It has more to do with, less to do with sex and more about self-esteem, and pointing out that there is a better way. Education is critical. And your article, I think, you know, a long time ago, I mean, it's been study after study has shown that the number one, influence on a child's life and their performance in school, the performance of life, is parental involvement. And your article goes on to state that, and I'm just amazed how often we overlook that factor.
It's hard to kind of wrap your head around the idea that you need to spend money to save money. And a lot of people have problems with that. And with schools in Oklahoma, we are number one in cutting education. We've cut our budget by about, let's say, 20% in the last 5 years, and that's the highest of any in the union in the United States. And so our schools are under a lot of pressure. And so if you're just cut to come in and say, now you're going to teach sex education, a lot of educators are just under a lot of pressure. So I think what this is going to take is not just parental involvement. It's going to take those faith-based programs. It's going to take nonprofits. It's going to take people coming in and helping out schools and saying, you know what, we can be a mentor. Because sex education is about showing kids another way of life. And one of the last year, and I'll use this as an example, and it was sort of striking to me. I was interviewing some teen moms, and I went out to one of the more lower-income parts of the city, and they had a program for teen moms. And all of the, and I had three girls sitting in front of me, and they all had one-year-old children. They were 15, so they had gotten pregnant at 14. Some, I think two of them had the child at 14. One of them turned 15 when she had the child. And they were all in generational poverty. Their moms were teen moms. Their grandmothers, their dads were not really part of their lives, kind of in and out. All of them were dealing with drama with their baby dads who were not part of their lives. And it was just sort of striking to me that you're 14-year-olds who are in this situation. And in the interview, they kept saying, so I asked them, gosh, you're so young. I mean, what happened, you know? And they all said, well, we didn't think we'd be this young. We thought it'd be another couple of years. So they were already just assuming they were going to be mothers as teenagers. They thought they would make it to 16, but they didn't. The other part of the interview that struck me, I asked them, well, what social welfare programs are you on? What does it take to exist as a 15-year-old in the city and have a child? And all of them said, two of them were emphatic about saying nothing. We're not on any welfare, not any welfare at all. But when you drill down, I said, well, how do you afford diapers and formula? Well, we use WIC. They did not associate WIC with benefits. And I think conservative people would say, well, this is part of the problem. But they were not taught that. In their worlds, oh, and they also had child care subsidies. They were getting free child care through a program that's through the state. They didn't recognize that as being welfare. They were not taught any differently. That's what their mothers did. That's what their neighbors do. They live in a world where everyone gets this. It's hard to not be mad at them, but, you know, you have to sit back and say, they're children. This is how they were taught. They don't have another model. They don't have, you know, strong men in their lives saying, we're going to take care of you and get you out of this. And they don't have strong women saying, you shouldn't get pregnant this young, do something different from me. And so that's where I think, you know, you talk about the communities and the families. Sometimes you don't have good parental support, that, you know, some of these families don't have the parental support that are giving them the right path. So I think that's where I think as a community we have to get together and say, you know, we're going to help out. We're going to show. You want to be, you know, go into a school and be a mentor, and these kids are going to look to you and say, well, how do you afford that car? How do you get to do these cool things? Then you show them, well, I went to school. Well, this is my experience. And I think we need more of that. And I think people are reluctant to maybe do that. But I think that that's part of getting to this problem.
Well, I think you hit something very important. They were not taught that's part of the welfare. But even those who grew up in the middle class or upper middle class or grow rich, if you attended the University of Oklahoma, you were part of a welfare program because taxpayers fund a certain portion of her tuition. So therefore, if you got your graduate degree from the University of Oklahoma, taxpayers subsidize that. Would that not be also considered welfare?
Oh, well, you know, there's corporate welfare, too. No one wants to talk
exactly about
the tax breaks that companies give. But, I mean, I think that there's a role of government in all of this. But the social programs, and because I've covered that so much, they're just the easiest to beat up on. Because,
absolutely.
You know, they're just, you know, with the food stamp thing, it's really frustrating to see what they're wanting to do with food stamps. because we have so many in Oklahoma on food stamps, yet there's this movement to cut them. And it's like, well, when that happens, what comes up in its place? And there's this idea that, especially in conservative states like Oklahoma, lawmakers, and I've heard them say this, they are assuming that the faith-based community will step up and make up for that. In every agency I've talked to, the food banks especially, they're saying there's no way possible that they have the capacity to take the place of what government can do. Government is kind of serving this broad base. And that, you know, when you look at the statistics of what the faith-based community can do as far as, you know, raising social programs and being involved, if they were just to wholly replace what the government is providing to help the poor, they can't do it. There will be people literally starving. So, you know, it's easy to think it can be done, but it can't. And I do think that there is an important role for government to play in all this. And, but, you know, some people, the poorer people are not voting. And that's the hard thing about it. They get beat up on, and either they're disenfranchised for whatever reason. And so that's why I think that that's where I kind of try to come in and say, with my writing, at least try to show people a slice of life in our community that they may not firsthand see, and try to explain why that is.
I think that's the part of the problem you just hit it. I don't think we all recognize that we're part of the same system. We all receive some government help somewhere. Somewhere along the way, we may not recognize it, but we receive some help. And part of our duty and responsibility for the help we receive, we should pay back into the system. And I think that you just hit a good point. And I want to touch on another article that you wrote a while back, but it's relevant because we're not spending, or now in Oklahoma, they are starting to spend, but they cut money out of the educational. And I think you said 20%. But if I remember correctly, you cut 20% out of your educational budget over the state, but I think you increased your spending for prisons because it's a private industry, therefore, so we don't mind housing people. And if I'm remembering serves me correct, that Oklahoma spends about $27,000 per year per prisoner, but you spend less than $6,000 a year per student. Is that correct? I mean, the figures
That sounds about right. I think that the prison figure kind of changes, but at a minimum, it's $19,000 a year for minimum security, and it can go up to, you know, whatever it is. But yes, for per student, it might actually be a little less now per student. But let's just rounding it up, say $6,000. So yes,
okay,
less on education and more on prison.
So that doesn't make sense to me why we'd spend more on a prisoner. But you wrote an article that I just find. If it wasn't so sad to be happening in a state that I care about, it'd be laughable. For $31 marijuana sale, you guys send a lady to, 12 years in prison?
Yes. Yeah.
So tell us about
Patricia Fodica, that's what you're talking about. Okay, well,
absolutely.
The story came about because we – in Oklahoma, we're number one, again, ranking high and great things, number one in female incarceration rate. And so we just started, there were a group of us, about three reporters, we decided that we were going to examine that. And, you know, how is it that we rank this high? And we ranked number one, or went number one and number two, for as long, you know, we're talking 10 years. And so in looking at that, we wanted to break it down by county, wanted to sort of find out why are we sending these women to prison, what's it for? And what we found, it was by and large drug addiction, drug use. Even if they were in prison for things like assault, there's usually an addiction that goes with it. They're drunk, they're high. So we found that the biggest problem we have is addiction. But in doing this, we wanted to, of course, meet women and who are going to prison. And I had requested to follow a woman who was being booked into the prison on her first day for the first time. And it sort of, I said, you know, the way we set it up, some people wondered if it was kind of a setup deal or I had to have, you know, found this through some nefarious way or something. But I literally told the prison, I'll be there on a Wednesday. Whatever woman shows up for her first offense, I'll just follow her. Well, I found Patricia Spotted Crow, and she was more than willing to let me tell her story because she was really naturally kind of freaked out her first day. She'd never been there. And she told me her story eventually about what the crime was. And she told me she had sold $31 worth of pot, which is not very much. And the judge didn't like her. Judge is real, it was a rural county judge who has a zero tolerance policy on drug use in her county and sent her away for 12 years. Now, honestly, I didn't believe her at first because I'm sitting there in the prison hearing this, and, of course, my natural inclination is there has to be some other reason. There has to be more to the story. Also, she had four young children, four children under the age of 10. She was not married, and she had been arrested with her mother because it was at her mother's house, and her mother were both charged with selling pot. But again, it was the $31 a pot. So, you know, I hear her story and I, you know, follow her through the day to find out what life was like in prison. When I went to pull the case file, I could not believe it. She told me the honest to God truth. She had no priors. She did not even have a juvenile record. She had never even been arrested. I mean, she wasn't on the radar at all. Her case file showed she had no priors. She had moved back home with her mother. She had four young children. She had no job. She was a teen mom. Her mom, same situation. So they were in poverty, and they sold pot to an undercover, not an agent, but someone who, an informant. So it was someone who was a drug user in the community, but was working for the police officers, came and bought, you know, a couple of joints, and they turn around and arrest the mom, the grandmother, left the kids, called in DHS, I mean, this whole thing, search warrant, found no other drugs on the property, so it was literally like in, on her jacket is where it came from. And the judge was very upfront with me and said, yeah, I wanted to throw the book at them. I thought it was wrong for them to be selling drugs with kids in the house. So, and the judge's reasoning was why she sent the mother, the young mom, to prison was so the grandmother could watch the children. But the grandmother was, to say she had health problems is being nice about it. She had a lot of health problems. She could not have kept up with four kids. And we're talking the youngest kid was about 9 months old. So, you know, I use that to kind of show as an example that we are throwing women in prison, and it was costing us $19,000 a year to house her. Why we couldn't have sent her to you know, a rehab, to some, you know, a probation, and try to clean her life up a little bit to where she can function in society. And to me, it was an outrage. I mean, even as a, you know, reporter, I interviewed everyone involved, but when it's all said and done, we were going to have her in prison for 12 years for a couple of joints. She had four kids, and those kids were last time I checked with them, especially the older one, really struggling, really having a hard time in school, acting out. I just think we can do better, you know. And, you know, I kind of wonder, had she been in Tulsa County where we had drug courts and alternative sentencing, had she never, she may not have ever seen the prison gates. So we had an issue of inequitable justice. You know, what happens in one county is not what happens in the other. The judges kind of all over the place on their sentencing. And, you know, eventually Patricia's story sort of got out, really outraged people. And she was able to get, the parole board was upset. They were sort of not happy with this. And so a different judge knocked off about 4 years, but that still left her 8 years. And eventually the parole board member looked into her case independently, sort of had, it came up with the same conclusion. He was as outraged as anyone and brought up for early parole. So she ended up getting out about a year ago. And so far, you know, she's been doing okay, but, you know, it's a struggle for her. The last time she had no job skills. Her mom is still, they're living in a cramped house in poverty and in a small community who didn't really appreciate the coverage. So, you know, I wish we could say that our, you know, there were plans on the table to reform some of the prison systems here, but unfortunately politics has gotten in the way. So that's sort of up in the air. Things that were, they call it the Justice Reinvestment Act, and it passed with bipartisan support, and but now the governor's decided that she doesn't like it, and some of the other new lawmakers, you know, we have a changeover, and so they decided they don't like some of that. So that's sort of, right now, it's sort of in a political flux at the moment. I wish I had better news. I mean, Patricia got a break, but I guarantee you there are a lot of other women and men in prison that aren't getting that same break. So,
well, not that I know anything about politics, but I think if you study Oklahoma a little bit, you'll understand, for those that don't know, that the prison industry, the lobbyists there are very, very powerful. And several years ago, many years ago, you know, there was a great turn to turn the prison industry, privatize it, as with many states. And they're finding out that to privatize the prison industry costs taxpayers more, and the recidivism rate is higher. But if you think about it from a business point of view, you want the recidivism rate to be high because that means people are coming back in building your profits of your private prison industry. So therefore, in my opinion, as one who would be outside the political mainstream of Oklahoma, I think private prisons cause more crime because it creates better profits for the prisons. So, you know, I think that once you understand that when you have a system that rewards crime and punishes education, you're going to get the crime more than you will the education. So, you know, I think it's fascinating how those two articles, even though you didn't intend them to be that way, tie together, because it goes back to young mothers without skills, without focus, without hope, without a direction, what can happen, especially with a system that's really geared against them. I don't know anyone that comes from a multimillion-dollar family that would spend 10 years in prison for selling $31 or maintaining or selling $31 of marijuana. I just don't think it could be done in most parts of the United States.
What was interesting is she had a defense attorney who ended up getting disbarred later for some really unethical conduct. So she had clearly an effective counsel. I mean, it was just, yeah, and she didn't even have it. I mean, it was court-appointed attorney in a small town, and I grew up in a small town. So I know that, you know, sometimes you have families that are just, you know, have reputations. And I don't know her family enough, but I could see her being a victim of, well, you know, you go back generations and, you know, people talk about people, but, you know, basically justice was not fair, and it's not fair across the state here for that reason, because in Tulsa County, they have, you know, we've sort of built up in the last few years some pretty good alternative courts that give second, third, fourth chances, because when you're dealing with addiction, which is what this problem is, we're sending, you know, our prisons are mental health institutions. We have closed down some major mental health institutions in Oklahoma. And even the spots that we do have been lessened. And I think we are having in our state a real mental health crisis. There are just nowhere to go. And right now in Tulsa County, we have a county proposal that they want to, it's a county tax they want to assess. And part of that is, well, two major things. One is to make the jail bigger. And a lot of people, that's pretty controversial. But the reason they want to make it bigger is because they have no mental health facility. And there was a prosecutor, a longtime prosecutor, who was saying that it used to be a person comes in, the prosecution and the defense attorneys think, you know, this is a person who really needs some mental health counseling. We need to, you know, rather than put them through the justice system, let's try to get some mental health, and we'll work the legal aspects out. They don't have that anymore. That's not there. There's nowhere to send someone for an evaluation. So they're sent to jail, and they sit in a general population for days. It could be up to 6 days or more, waiting for someone to come and look at them for a mental health evaluation, and that's a huge problem. So what they're wanting to do are build two big units and staff them just for mental health evaluations, because there's nowhere to get that help. And then the other thing they want to use the county tax force to build a juvenile bureau, which is sorely overdue. And the juvenile bureau they have cases involving juvenile crimes, but also for kids who are abused and neglected. And this all tied together. You know, you talked about the teen pregnancy being tied to the jail or the prison system, without a doubt. Because when you look at all the studies that are done on the demographics of the people that are going to prison, they come from, some disenfranchised families. You know, families, you know, they're oftentimes children of teen parents. The moms, the women that were sending to prison, a lot of them have children. Well, what's happening to kids? One thing we found in the reporting, no one could tell us how many of the women we had in prison had children, because no one was asking. No court, when they were sentencing women, asked them, do you have children? Where are your children? And for that matter, you know, why not ask men the same question? You know, we've always approached teen pregnancy as a women's issue, very much a men's issue, too. And so I think there needs to be education on that part. But, you know, I think that the mental health aspect of all of this has sort of gotten me lately, because I just see so many people in need of just sometimes just talk, talk therapy. And sometimes maybe a little more. Maybe they need something, but it's not there. And I think that it kind of exacerbates some of these other societal problems we have, because people are just not getting the kind of support and help they need.
Well, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, because you probably are more well-versed in that. You had an institution called HISM a long time ago,
mm-hmm.
that I believe handled patients, for lack of better words, patients for about a quarter of the cost that it cost to maintain the mental health of a prisoner. And for whatever reason, Oklahoma made a shift, especially Tulsa County, when they got really conservative politically, and they did away with them as a cost-saving factor. And that's coming around to kind of bite you in the butt now, I think, is it not?
It wasn't HISM. HISM was the facility that housed developmentally disabled people. And what they found was it was sort of, and this was disbanded before I started working here. It was disbanded probably about 25 years ago. But what they found was it was sort of a little shop of horrors, that they were just housing developmentally disabled people and kind of throwing away the key. And they weren't being cared for, rehabbed. But what I'm sort of talking about are, and I think Vinita, I think you may be familiar with a facility that was in Vinita, where we're talking about mental health in the way of getting help for addictions, you know, things that maybe they're a person schizophrenic or bipolar and just needs an evaluation and get some help to be on the right road, can function fine in society. But when you don't have that, then a person slides down into behaviors that end up being criminal. And that's where it's going to cost us. So it does cost, again, it costs more to house someone in the end for a crime they might not have even committed had they just gotten mental health therapy that they needed. And so, you know, and again, you know, how do you turn that bus around is sort of where I think you need some pretty charismatic and knowledgeable lawmakers, elected officials. And so, you know, when I'm going to the voter booth, I'm always looking. That's what I'm looking for. Do I have someone who's going to stand up for those people and not just be looking to cut costs? Because it's easy to cut costs on those kind of things. And no one wants to be soft on crime. That's really where we're at right now. Is the Justice Reinvestment Act? The reason it's all of a sudden we have some people who are not supporting it. And this was born out of some email, a story that some reporters did. They got email between elected officials that showed they were backing off of that, which was going to kind of help restructure the prison system that would allow more people to have, say, ankle monitors, things that would keep them at home, not just in prison, alternative
right.
courts. The reason that they were backing off of that now was because President Obama has supported those efforts. And so
yeah.
if you're a Republican backing those efforts, it could come back on you at election time. And so these private email that our reporters were looking at showed it's not the decision to not back that Reinvestment Act had nothing to do with whether it was good for our community, but whether it was good for their campaign. And
correct.
And that was really troublesome, you know, and that's,
well,
and I do want to point out, you know, we were talking earlier about, you know, just reporting, you had mentioned private prisons, and this
yes.
kind of may or may not be off the subject, but since I'm talking about reporting, we had private prisons come in, and we've had had a private company operating the jail, we had a hard time with open records. Because
yep.
they hid behind, they said, well, because we're a private prison or a private company, we don't have to give you documents. And we had to get attorneys involved to get things like basic jail records, mugshots, that are clearly an open record. But because they're a private company, we had to fight that. And with the email I was referring to, we used the Open Records Act to get at that email. And so, you know, I think as if anyone listening, when we talk about open records, everything that we've talked about, I've been able to find out, and other reporters have found out through open record. And so I just want to put a plug in there to make people aware of how important that aspect is.
It's very, very important. And I really appreciate you coming on tonight. You as always, are a wealth of knowledge. I've got one final – I got to wrap this up, but I got one final question.
I talk too much. You see, you're going to regret asking me to be on here.
No. We'll ask you again. You are exactly what our country needs. We want people who go behind what we read on the headlines, because you're one of the few people that I know in this world that really go for the facts, whether it's, you know, politically to the left, politically to the right. You don't really, as long as I've known you, you really can't say you're right or left. You're a reporter. You go for what the facts are, and I've always admired that about you. So now if someone wants to get a hold of you and learn more about what you know, or learn how to be a reporter, or learn how to really ascertain the facts from a case rather than listening to, you know, political people on the left or right, how can they get a hold of you?
Well, you know, through the Tulsa World, I mean, through our Tulsa World website, you can find me. It's TulsaWorld.com. You can look at my name there. I'm also on Twitter, just at Jenny Graham is my Twitter handle. And I'm on Facebook. I pretty much, welcome. I put a lot of my stuff on Facebook, and I also tweet out a lot of my work, too, and the work of my colleagues. And, you know, we cover very local issues. And that's one thing that, you know, wherever people are listening from, every once in a while I'll get a call of someone saying, why don't you check into this about Obama? And I kind of laugh and say, well, you know, I don't cover the president, but, you know, anything that has to do with Oklahoma or Tulsa, you know, that's my home. And I think reporters, whether they're in, you know, Terre Haute or Gary, Indiana, or wherever they're at, they're going to cover their local community as well. So, you know, I hope people will support their local newspaper, their local media, because, you know, national politics can be fun as a spectator sport, but I do think the local politics, the local happenings, that affects you directly. And so, you know, support reporters who are, you know, sitting in those county commission meetings and city hall and school board meetings, because if you can't do it, someone's got to do it and report back to you what's going on. So, you know, my local website, TulsaWorld.com, and all my information's on there. So,
there you have it. Jenny, thank you so much for coming on tonight. Please, people, get a hold of Jenny. Let her know that you want to know more how she does things and how she investigates the facts. Jenny, again, thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Well, thank you. It's nice talking to you again, Harry.
Oh, my pleasure.
Okay. All right. So.
Wow, everybody was happy to hear Jenny and Harry tonight. Thank you again, Jenny. We really appreciated hearing what you had to say regarding teen pregnancies and the prison system. Not necessarily the happiest news, but part of leaving a positive legacy is knowing what to do to make things better. Go to the polls, volunteer, teach your child the way you need to teach your child. Those are just some things that you can do to help in those areas. Harry, what you got?
Well, I got to tell you, she hit something very important, and that is that all politics is local. President Obama gets too much blame or too much credit. If you really want to impact your quality of life, if you really want to make a difference, a local politician has more impact, far greater than President Obama ever thought about having about your life. So Jenny's exactly right. If you really care about your community, get involved in local politics.
Absolutely. That is definitely one thing that you've helped me see is all politics are local. So, yes, go out to the polls, learn about your representatives, learn about those city councilmen, learn about the people that are taking care of the issues that really directly affect you. Have a quick break. We're going to listen to a song from Amy Hendrickson. We started out tonight, I did forget to let you know, with The Machine. Amy writes most of her work, and The Machine is a Amy Hendrickson original. If you love Amy when you hear her on our show, you're anywhere near St. Augustine, Florida. You can find her at many of the local restaurants performing. You can go to AmyHendricksonMusic.com to see her schedule. Take a quick break with a little bit of Amy. Teach my rock how to roll.
Life's born melancholy. It always surrounds me. It's easier to be blue when your eyes always match your mood. But it's not fun to dance to. It's worse to romance too. I've got to change it, rearrange it, and teach my rock how to roll. Here we go. Here we go, yeah. Been praying to the rock gods. I'm gonna bring in the big dogs. See if they can help me to groove. Well, I've been talking to Jimmy, jiving with Janice Story. I spoke to Lennon too. The outtake girl, do your thing. Let it win, let it rain. Free the beast from the cage. Walker's music's divine, and it's a free state of mind. It means everything. Well, it's all I dream about. Well, it took me too long to figure it out. Okay, yes.
Okay, yes. I love me some Amy Hendrickson. And today, you know, today's a special day as we reflect upon a man who sacrificed his life so all Americans could reap the blessings of liberty. One of the greatest sins against our liberties is ignorance and apathy to the founding principles of the United States of America. You know, I think Dr. Martin Luther King said it best in his letter from the Birmingham jail when he said, "Shallow understanding from people of goodwill is more frustrating than absolute misunderstanding from people of ill will." Lukewarm acceptance is much more bewildering than outright rejection. He wrote that while he sat in a Birmingham jail, standing up for rights that many of us take for granted. When we fail to understand the basic principles and believe ourselves to be omnipotent, it is then we fail our blessings of liberty and have succumbed to the brainwashing. Self-development requires unbiased, factual education as the best course of individual action. There is no one right path. I mean, each of us must be held accountable for our actions because we live the results. We must understand the rules of self-development. Open your eyes, people, and realize you are capable of so much more. Understand that self-development is an understanding that is on fire with truth and passion. Once you see your capabilities, you must plant your seeds of action in fertile soil. Dr. Martin Luther King planted his seeds in fertile soil. If you fall upon if those words fall upon poisoned ears, they will be misunderstood. Your actions will wither and die if planted in poisoned soil. I mean, it's damn near impossible for a plant to grow in poisoned soil. We are like plants. Each of us are like plants in need for enrichment. If you wish to grow and to live to your potential, the soil in which you live must be fertile. You are responsible for maintaining your soil's condition. Each of us, it is our responsibility. And one method of maintaining good soil for personal growth and development is to ensure the growth of those around you. Here is one key. One key I have found. Do not let anyone around you, not anyone, let their good efforts go unrecognized. Allow us all to use the American game of baseball. That's what I'm going to use, ball as an example. Baseball is a game of recognition and statistics for a reason. I mean, recognition is at the heart of why people play professional baseball. You have, let me see, the Baseball Hall of Fame. You have the MVP, the Cy Young Award. And if Dr. Mason was here, he would tell me a lot more. I mean, you have the All-Star Game, Rookie of the Year. You have Comeback Player of the Year. What else we got? We got the Golden Glove. And there's so many more awards and methods of recognition. And if money were enough, there would be no playoffs, no World Series, no egos. Wanting to be recognized for their efforts and talents is a major factor in baseball. It is a major factor in football. I mean, I can attest, it is a major factor for competing in the ring. I would pay $25-$50 to go compete and win a little bitty trophy. Awards and recognition are major components in all that we do. Humans, we crave recognition of some fashion. We have a need within us to be appreciated and recognized for being who we are. Recognition is a driving force in why we do what we do. The thought of making $1 million is a driving force. But I'm pretty confident Peyton Manning would give up $1 billion of his salary for one more Super Bowl ring. I mean, whether it's football, baseball, your occupation, or just life in general. Everyone, I mean, everyone needs to know they are appreciated and their work was noticed. As Ron White points out, baseball can teach us two very important lessons. The first lesson would be that people thrive on rewards. And whether you're making $25,000 per game or $25,000 per year, recognition and rewards motivate and drive you. The second lesson is to track your success. Baseball is full, like I said, of statistics and awards for a reason. Track your success and the success of those people around you. Acknowledge and reward those that achieve success. People will be drawn to those that recognize and reward their efforts. People seek that recognition and that appreciation. So if you wish to develop those around you, recognize and appreciate their efforts with their methods that resonate with them. If you fail to do this, I promise you, if you fail to do this, the circle of accomplished and successful people around you will disappear. If you wish to accomplish your goals and live your dreams, you must surround yourself with accomplished people. People will gravitate to those that show recognizable appreciation. The rewards must resonate with them. Kicking a field goal to a baseball player means very little in the awards category. Telling a surgeon how well he hits a baseball may not resonate. Keep stats that are of importance to the individual and show appreciation. Soil around you, fertile. Know where you're at, know where you're going, know how to get there, and measure your success along the way. Plant yourself in the soil of great people living a life of passion, achieving the greatness they were designed.
Thank you.
Oh, but it wasn't right for you to cross my path to find my doorknob, yes. I remember everything about that day. Well, your smile, your smell, your words blew me away. Yeah, 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 yeah. All right.
More beautiful words from Amy Hendrickson. I love you, I said. It's the name of that song. Tonight, for our yoga wisdom, I run into people daily that come to my yoga classes that say that they've been wanting to do yoga for a long time, but just didn't know where to start. I run into people on the street that once we start the conversation about my being a certified yoga instructor, then of course they'll say, I've been to a yoga class. I want to go to more yoga classes. But people tend to have a hard time knowing how to get started in yoga. So I just wanted to throw a couple of things out there to help you decide the best way for you to get started. There are many types of yoga, and yoga came to us, as most of you know, from the East. And in the West, most Americans are drawn initially to practicing yoga for the physical aspect. But we know that yoga also includes other aspects more than just the physical. Patanjali speaks to the eight limbs of yoga. And most yoga classes that we attend here in the United States are focused on the asanas and pranayama. Asanas being your physical body, the pranayama being your breath. Those are two of the eight limbs of yoga that are focused on in Western yoga. But then, even knowing that, when you choose a yoga class anywhere in the United States, you could be walking into totally different types of yoga. There are many, many different lineages of yoga, many different traditions. But some of the main types that you'll find, at least in Jacksonville, Florida, and I think across the country, I've found pretty close to the same style. The first one you'll see, overall, all of the styles that I'm about to tell you about are vinyasas. The vinyasa style yoga combines a series of flowing postures, so it's not the typical posture that you'll stand, you'll hold for a long time. Usually they're flowing with your rhythmic breath, your pranayama, combining those with certain aspects of the asana, your physical posture. So out of the vinyasa type classes, you have Ashtanga, and the practice of Ashtanga is getting mainstream attention. Everyone loves it. If you're looking for a fast-paced yoga practice that you do not tend to typically hold your poses very long, you can work in your own pace. There's not a lot of time for adjustment, and you'll just be encouraged to breathe, matching your breath to your movement. Then there is power yoga. If classes were advertised as Ashtanga yoga, many Americans wouldn't go. That just sounds a little too mysterious. But when we change the word to power yoga, people tended to flock to the classes. So Ashtanga yoga, power yoga, very, very similar. Just a natural flowing class. You're matching your breath to your flow. And in each one of those categories, you're going to have a little bit of difference depending on what studio and even sometimes within the studio, which teacher. Then you also have a type of yoga called Iyengar, And INGAR is one that you may be interested in if you tend to pay a lot of attention to detail, because this form of yoga does your alignment, your breath, your physical posture. Everything is scrutinized. Every little detail matters. You tend to use a lot of props. When you're going to most any yoga class, walk in a yoga class with a bottle of water, a towel, and a mat, and you're set. Because most yoga classes provide your blankets, your blocks, your props. So in certain classes, you'll use those props more than others. INGAR looks to be using those props to help you with your poses. Bikram yoga. A lot of conversation about Bikram yoga. If you go to a Bikram yoga class, you may already know, be prepared to sweat. You're going to have temperatures designed to replicate yoga's birthplace, and temperatures are going to be pushing around 100 degrees Fahrenheit. Why? Because sweat helps your body rid itself of toxins. You're going to go through a series of 26 traditional hatha postures to address the proper functioning of every bodily system. Very challenging class. Drink lots of water the night before. Also, there is a type of yoga that focuses a tremendous amount on the eight limb of pranayama with your dynamic breathing techniques. They also incorporate much chanting and meditating on mantras, and you're going to deal with much conversation and much work dealing with your seven chakras, the energy centers. And chances are, if you go to a class that's advertised as a hatha class, you're going to find that the teacher may be offering an eclectic blend of two or more of those styles that I've just described. It's a good idea to ask the teacher or the director of the studio where he or she was trained, and if the poses are held for an extended length of time, or if it's more of a flow type class. Nice to sample more than one type of yoga class, and that can best be accomplished by visiting different yoga classes in your city. Many times if you call ahead, you'll find it, or visit their website, that they do offer either the first or sometimes I've noticed the second class for free. A lot of yoga drop-in classes are around $15 a class, just to give you an idea. And then also, there are a lot of saving type websites, Groupon being one of them. Groupon, so if you're a Groupon person, always be on the lookout for a yoga studio in your area. There are plenty of Groupons to be found for yoga studios. So whatever it takes to get you out there, don't be fearful. It's really not all that mystical and magical. Just get off the couch and get moving. Thank you for joining us this evening. Remember, you can email us at legacyforum@yahoo.com. Remember the words of one of Harry's heroes: if we could only see ourselves as others would. Mr. Leon Russell. Now go out there and make someone else happy.